Saul, where were you, what was your position during the war? Did you, were you in an office, or were you in combat? Were you
no
in
combat.
This country, out of the country?
In this country. I really didn't like that either. No, like a lot of intellectuals, if I may put it that way, I wound up in a place called Chase Field, St. Louis, where radio instruction was taking place. And I was an instructor in the field of radio for a while. I finished the war being a radio operator in an airplane, but I never went overseas.
And did you get your radio training in the service, or did you have that before?
I got it in the service.
Mm-hmm. And what was your, did you have a commission? Were you an officer, non-commissioned?
No, I don't know if I ever made sergeant. I think I made sergeant.
Did you enlist?
Was it a corporal or a sergeant? I'm not sure anymore.
Did you enlist, or were you drafted?
No, I was drafted.
And
we reenact, well, it doesn't make a difference. I was drafted.
Were you in various parts of the country, or
yeah,
did you more or less stay in one place?
No, I was all over the country. I was in Louisiana, and Illinois, and California, and Nebraska.
Now, can you tell?
Reno. Must forget Reno. I enjoyed myself in Reno.
I'm sure you have visited Israel many times.
No, twice.
Twice. When was that?
1968-1976.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure that through your involvement with UJF, you have worn many hats. Can you start at the very beginning and tell us something about your beginnings at UJF, your involvement in work? What did you do then when you first started?
Well, as I told you before, I wandered into the UJF. I said I almost left it in 48. But I didn't.
What did you have in mind then that you say you almost left it?
And I did leave it in 50, by the way, thinking about it. That's right, Sylvia. In 1948, I was offered by Wallace Richards an opportunity to go back into city planning. It wasn't city planning, regional planning. He was really a key person in planning, later became later became the civic advisor to the Mellons, and has always been considered to be among the top two or three planners. And he wanted me to come back. I had worked with him. It was quite close. I played a lot of ping pong with him on top of everything else. And he pushed me pretty hard. But anyway, I didn't. I've often thought about it. Not often, but I thought once in a while about it. But whatever the reasons were, I decided not to do it. And in 1950, I did leave for 3 months to engage in a business venture with a fellow by the name of Andrew Sylvia.
Really?
Yeah, but that didn't work out either. And if I say so myself, I was under a lot of pressure in 1950 to come back to the Federation. The office, I was still running the office, and the office missed me. Tibby will put it more strongly than that. And so I did come back. And in the first several years, I don't know, let's see what, until about 1954, 55 actually, I ran the office and I did some budgeting and supervised personnel, had an administrative position of that type, but in terms of involvement in significant policy making and so forth, not too much of that as I think back over it. But in 1955, several things happened. First of all, Dr. Taylor came down with cancer. He died in about a year and was replaced by Bob Hiller. And number two, the United Jewish Fund and the Federation were merged, which is worth talking about, into the United Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. From that point on, I became involved in policy making, not very often in the campaign, rather odd. Once in a while I was involved in the campaign, but whatever the reasons were, I didn't have much to do with the campaign as the years went by. But on almost all the other aspects of the Federation. I was intimately involved, whether it be merger of the community relations, or planning, or budgeting, or erection of this particular building as I look around, whatever it may be.
Well, you mentioned many mergers. Can you go back to the very beginning? What was the original organization called?
Well, the Federation, in 1955, let's put it that way, there were still in existence two central organizations. One was called the United Jewish Fund, one was called the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies. I don't know how elaborate you want me to be on this. I'll tell
us. We're interested in your being very elaborate. We want to know the whole background.
Well, if you want me to be elaborate, I can be, but it'll take a while, because the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies was an outgrowth of the relationship. Well, let me put it differently. The Federation of Jewish Philanthropies, as it existed in 1955, was an outgrowth of the relationship between the Federation and the Community Chest. Let me start over again then.
Surely.
We
want the whole background.
You want more, okay, to be more elaborate. First of all, as in all Jewish communities, the...
May I just interrupt 1 minute? You said you started in 1948. I think we would 47. Like... 47. We would like the background of the organization from that time on.
All right, except with one qualification. Just let me finish this one quick statement then, which is that in 1947 then, there were two organizations. One was called the United Jewish Fund, one was called the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies. They had the same personnel, however, but there were two organizations. This was typical around the country. At one time or another in the Jewish community. What happened, and this is what I mean by I want to add something, what happened was that going back into the early 1900s, or actually the very first one in Boston in 1895, various Jewish-sponsored social welfare agencies that were already in existence decided that they were competing with one another and that this was causing lots of problems. The competition was a result of pressures being exerted by heavy immigration into this country by Jews, starting particularly in 1881 when the Tsar in Russia was assassinated. I'm sure this is all past Sylvia, because we've had all sorts of leadership development programs and so forth where we've gone through all this.
It's always good to hear it, Saul.
And it's brand new to me.
Well, okay. It's interesting, as a matter of fact. In Pittsburgh, the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies was created and organized in 1912 by such organizations as the Montefiore Hospital, Jewish Home for Aged, some of the agencies which now make up the Jewish Family and Children's Service, and so forth. These were all agencies who were offering services to local Pittsburgh Jewish residents who had welfare needs. Not so much spiritual needs, but physical needs. In the 20s, to some extent, but very much in the 30s, as a result of the problems that arose in Europe, particularly after Hitler, there began to be very substantial pressure for funds to be spent in Europe for the needs of Jews in Europe, as contrasted for the needs of Jews locally. The reason I included the 20s was because there was already some effort being made to raise money for Jews to be settled in Israel, or those days, of course, Palestine. But after Hitler, the pressure in Europe became very strong. There was a United Palestine appeal, which began to push very hard. American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, which had been established back, I think, in 1918 during World War I, also had expanded very substantially and so forth. And around the country in the 30s, a second central fundraising organization for money to be spent in Europe, that second central fundraising organization began to be created. I hope I've made myself clear. There was initially a central fundraising organization to raise and distribute money for local agencies responding to the needs of local residents, primarily. In the 30s, a second central fundraising organization was created to raise money to be spent in Europe to meet the needs of residents in Europe. Okay?
Fine.
All right. Very early, there began to be discussion about the possibility of the merger of these two organizations. But in 1947, that kind of discussion, and that's when I'm starting, that kind of discussion had not taken any serious form in Pittsburgh. At that time, the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies was receiving money, I better not go into this, but was receiving money not by a direct fundraising campaign in the Jewish community, but rather from the community chest. This was a result of an agreement between the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies and the community chest when the community chest was organized back in 1932. Prior to 1932, I really didn't mean to digress this way. Prior to 1932, the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies raised its own money in the Jewish community. When the community chest was organized by agreement, the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies gave up that right to go out to the community, the Jewish community, and raise its own money, and instead allowed the community chest to raise money in the Jewish community along with the total community, and then gave money to the Federation, allocated money to the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies. Can I make myself clear?
Yes.
Okay. So that's where we were in 1947. Federation of Jewish Philanthropies getting money from the community chest, money going to their local agencies, the Montefiore Hospital, Jewish Home and Hospital for the Aged, Jewish Family and Children's Service, it wasn't that then, but it doesn't make any difference, and so forth. And on the other side, United Jewish Fund raising money primarily for the United Jewish Appeal, which, if you want, we can talk about. If not, we'll just use the name. But the United Jewish Appeal is the conduit by which money goes overseas to be served mostly in Israel and also by the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. And in some ways, the most interesting aspect of that was that a lot of people thought, and I think with a fair amount of justice, in 1947, that split, that is the word I'm looking for, I can't find it, it doesn't make any difference, that the differentiation between the Federation on the one hand and the fund on the other was a reflection of the allegiances of the German Jews, as Jews of German background, allegiances of German Jews, particularly to the Montefiore Hospital, and the allegiances of Eastern European Jews, particularly to Israel. And there was, from 1947 on, a great deal of vigorous and spirited discussions and the differences between the adherence of the two positions, having to do with the way money was allocated and how fundraising campaigns took place and business of loans and all of that. And I won't go into any names, but there were certain individuals who seemed to exemplify German-Jewish strains and adherence and support of the Federation and others who seem to exemplify the United Jewish Fund's East European Zionist orientation.
Saul, if you feel comfortable in putting that down, I think it would really be important for this record to give us some of these names. It's certainly nothing personal about these people. I think it would be very, very relevant.
Well, for instance, in the hospital, there's no question that in those days, at least, I think already in 47, I.D. Wolf was certainly a representative of what would be called the German tradition, and certainly of the support of the hospital. I don't know whether you know this or not, but the Montefiore Hospital, for as you can tell by some of the names, was looked upon for many years as a Kaufman venture. There have been some very, very vigorous and fierce disputes within the Jewish community over certain matters.
I didn't know that.
For instance, an extraordinary episode took place in long before 1947, I think, was it? Between Edgar Kaufman on the one hand and Hyman Rogal on the other, in connection with the control of the Y, Oakland Y. Extremely bitter fight. And I think to most people's amazement, Hyman Rogal won. Some of the very interesting things to talk about really are the characters of some of these men who were very strong and very committed.
Well, what caused the dispute?
What caused the dispute?
Yes.
I really don't remember because I really wasn't involved what the specific issue was, but the overall issue was the question, I think, of who was going to be president, if I remember rightly. And it was very, very narrow, and this I really won't say who was supposed to be, but the saying always was that the election went to Rogel instead of the Kaufman because someone didn't keep his word and voted for Jaime instead of for Edgar. Great bitterness, as a matter of fact, people wouldn't talk to each other for years after that and so forth. That had to do with the why, though. The hospital, the dispute there was between the Falks and the Kaufmans, going back to the days, this is long before my time, going back to the days when the Montefiore was making a decision as to where it was going to be when it moved from the Hill District and came out here in Oakland. On that, the Kaufmans won, and Falk left and created the Falk Clinic.
Well, that's very interesting. Didn't know that background.
That's what they say. That's the story. Anyway, in 1947, there were the two organizations that worked with the same personnel. The story there is that in 1947, there was fierce hostility, and I don't want to gossip, so I'll be very careful how I phrase this, but that there was fierce hostility between Leon Falk and Maurice Taylor, and that Falk took the chairmanship, I guess it was 47, of a campaign with the stipulation that Taylor was to have nothing to do with it.
Now, what was Taylor's position at that
time? He was the executive of both organizations.
I see. He was the paid worker.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And a very substantial social scientist, but very poor at public relations. And because of this lack, as the years went by, and this is crucial to the success of an executive of an organization of this sort, as the years went by, the extent of his support, and in some ways the intensity of his support from the lay people kept diminishing, so that by the time 1955 had arrived, he only had a very small group, and most of them not too important in terms of community leadership, who really felt committed to him. Not too unusual, by the way, in those days particularly. Anyway, that was 1947. They had the two organizations. And in a sense, they were the same organizations, and in a sense, they were two separate ones. You know, the same personnel, but with two separate functions and so forth. And but the important changed, as I said, I won't go into all the business with the hospital and so forth. The important changes took place in 1955 and 56 when Taylor, as I said, Dr. Taylor, became ill, and he was eventually replaced by Robert Hiller. And at the same time, the United Jewish Fund and the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies merged into the United Jewish Federation of Pittsburgh, now the United Jewish Federation of Greater Pittsburgh. In those days it was the United Jewish Federation of Pittsburgh. That was significant for several reasons. One of the reasons being that it had a lot of impact upon the relationship with the community chest and with the agencies, which I'll get back to. The most important significance, of course, was that it was the first step towards a certain kind of unification in the Jewish community. Feelings of separateness and so forth between at least German Jews and East European Jews, and to some extent between Zionists and non-Zionists and so forth, was still in existence in 1955, but began to steadily diminish and dissolve from that time on. The image that the Federation had of being Concordia controlled, and I'm sure Sylvia is sensitive to this, took many more years to dissolve. Well, I think that's been dissolved now, although I don't know.
Why was there such hostility between the German Jews and the European Jews?
Well, there are, I think, several reasons. Some people have always argued that in the Jewish community and in the non-Jewish community, to start with, there are natural, if you want to call it that, superiority attitudes. And certainly in the Jewish community, people talk freely about the differences between it's really geographic origins between the Litvaks and the Germans and the Galicianers and the Hungarians and so forth. And I think there is some differences there. As a matter of fact, historically, there was a great deal of bitterness between serious bitterness for many, many years between what might be called the Galicianers, although it goes beyond that, and the Litvaks, although again it goes beyond that geographically, having to do with the struggle many years ago, well, 200 plus years ago, having to do with the struggle between the Hasidim, as it was called, on the one hand, and the Misnagdim on the other, which means the intellectuals, that's the Litvaks on the one hand, and the Hasidim on the other. And to some extent, I think maybe some of that still went on. The German Jews.
Excuse me, do you want to define Litvaks and Galicianers in terms of,
the Galicianers,
I guess, its geographic origin?
Galiciana is sort of right around Austria and Hungary and so forth, but basically I think in the Carpathian Mountains. Look up the Carpathian Mountains, the valleys of the Carpathian Mountains. The Litvaks are up towards Lithuania and northern, I guess, Poland and so forth. But there was a tremendous difference in terms of the religious. The Hasidim basically do come from valleys, that's the best way I can put it, the Carpathian Mountains. There were any number of little Hasidic dynasties,
all
of which were wiped out.
Name? I can understand how they got the name Litvak, but how did they get the name Hasidim?
Well, that's a different thing, having such a Hebrew term, I guess, just simply defining the fact that had a certain attitude towards life and so forth. Didn't have to do with intellectuals, although Hasid, to start with, means a very righteous man and so forth. And it was righteousness and so forth, which was outstanding among the Hasidim, not being intellectually observant of the Torah and the Talmud and so forth. But that's a different thing. Anyway, getting back to 1955, as I say, that was, I think, the beginning of the unification and so forth. It had a big impact with the community chest, and it was as a result of that that the Montefiore Hospital was forced out of the community chest. It's a very important thing at the time. When the unification took place, I should say, because I'm thinking about it, there probably isn't anybody else floating around that's going to say it, I'm going to describe it. There was a process that got underway. It took several years of trying to bring the fund and the federation together into a single organization. This had already happened in other communities, yes. Of course. There were still people who were suspicious of the other. For instance, Sam Goldstock happens to be a good example. That's who I think of it. I hope my memory is right. But Sam was a very... Remember Sam?
Of course.
You know?
Sure.
He was, of course, an ardent and a devoted Zionist, and he had some questions about what would happen to the allocation of funds if the merger took place. This became a key issue, you see. The merger took place, there'd be a single board, then decisions would have to start being made as to where funds would be allocated. Would the Montefiore now get more or less? Would Israel now get more or less? Very crucial, very important. And Sam, if my memory serves me right, was very strongly opposed to it. Federation of Jewish Philanthropies, I don't remember now that there was anybody who was particularly opposed to it. And if there was a meeting of the membership, it was not a very important meeting. The United Jewish Fund, on the other hand, I remember rather well. The United Jewish Fund had a membership meeting, which they had to, by bylaws. And there were several hundred people showed up. And there were speeches from the floor opposing the merger. Sam made one. I have a strange feeling that Sam Fuss made one. Trying to visualize, I think there may have been another one or two. But anyway, Bernard Kaplan spoke for the merger, I remember that. Anyway, the motion for the merger carried, and the United Jewish Fund and the Federation disappeared into the United Jewish Fund.
And that
Pittsburgh.
Was 1955.
55, yes. Yes, I guess the actual date was 55. I really should remember because I wrote the bylaws with Lewis Kaplan and Phil Baskin. Lewis Reisenstein, who was named the first president of the United Jewish Federation. Not elected, he was named the first president.
Well, why was he named instead of being elected?
They weren't ready for an election yet. They needed someone to occupy the position for that first interim year. And Louis was acceptable to everyone.
Just have a couple minutes now.
Louis was acceptable to everyone. He had been a supporter of all causes, and he was liked by, I guess, everyone, and he seemed to be what would be called an acceptable compromise candidate, and so he was named. In the meantime, they were searching for the first executive, and they finally settled on Bob Hiller.
Was he a Pittsburgher?
No. Bob came from Cleveland, where he had been campaign director. Out of the last four executives that we've had, three have come from Cleveland. Bob came. He was young. I don't know that. I don't think he was yet 35, but he was quite impressive in many ways. Had a lot of maturity, had some immaturity. You can leave that in, Sylvia. But I'll be careful how I characterize these people. And he came in, I guess, in 1955 or 56. I don't remember anymore. It doesn't make any difference, really. And became the first executive. And then eventually the first election took place. And Lewis Kaplan was elected the first president. And it used to irk Lewis Kaplan.
First president?
First elected president of the United Jewish Federation. It used to irk Lewis Kaplan